This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Stan Correy, and this is Rear Vision on RN. Where today we hear the story of Edward Said's book of literary and cultural criticism, Orientalism, and how it became one of the most controversial books of the 20th century. It was a book that turned the gaze around and focused directly on the caricatures, clichés and preconceptions of Western scholars who had for centuries claimed to understand Islam and the East. Said argued that what seemed like objective expertise in fact provided the power and knowledge for European colonialism. And the colonial mindset continues to this very day. Academics like British historian Robert Irwin wrote the most sustained attack on Said's Orientalism.
Well, it never occurred to me when I started working in the field back in the 60s and the history of medieval Egypt and Syria, Islamic art, the Arabian Nights, classical Arabic literature, that I was doing something dangerous, disreputable, potentially pro-Zionist and imperialist. But then Edward Said, the cultural critic, the Palestinian spokesman, produced that famous or perhaps notorious book, Orientalism, in 1978. In which he denounced the whole tradition of the study of Islam and the Arabs and attitudes to the East. He went all the way back to Homer and Aeschylus and then through the Middle Ages and through Bonaparte's invasion of Egypt up to modern times, attacking a whole range of academics who'd worked on Arabic and Persian and the study of Islam. And he'd made them accomplices of imperialism and racism.
Orientalism this year celebrates its 40th anniversary. And on Rear Vision, we'll hear from Edward Said speaking about Orientalism just a few months after it was published. 1978, and especially 1979, were without a doubt tumultuous times in the Orient. There was the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and of course there was the Arab-Israeli conflict. Middle East experts of all kinds were asked on an almost daily basis to explain the Middle East and increasingly the role of Islam in the politics of the region. The East, the Orient, was in the eye of a geopolitical storm, and Said's Orientalism had plenty to say about how Western policymakers had got into such a mess. Here's Edward Said on ABC Radio in 1979.
The Orient has been a source of a lot of sort of imaginative constructions. I mean, the marvels of the East, the exoticism of the East, and then from there all kinds of other constructions come out of it, Oriental sensuality, Oriental despotism, Oriental mode of production, and so on and so forth. But all of them have one, all of these things have one thing in common, and that is that that somehow the Orient sort of left there isn't to be, that the Orient in some way has to be controlled as much for its wealth and its spaces and its strange people as for its distance and its peculiarity. And I think underneath the whole thing is a desire for domination and control, which has never been far away from thinking about the Orient.
Edward Said was born in Jerusalem, in the British Mandate of Palestine in 1935. After the creation of Israel in 1948, his family went into exile. Said died of leukemia in 2003, but in 1978 he was professor of comparative literature at Columbia University in New York, a literary scholar and a world expert on the novels of another political exile, Polish-English novelist Joseph Conrad, a musician and a lover of classical music, especially Beethoven. The journey to writing Orientalism began after another political earthquake in the Middle East, the Six-Day War in June 1967.
The Arab rout was so swift that by the end of the first day, newsman Michael Elkins could give this report.
Less than 15 hours after the fighting began at dawn this morning, there was every evidence that Israel has already won the war, though fighting will continue. The Israeli armor has sliced through the Gaza Strip to the Mediterranean coast, and the Arab forces in the Strip are no longer a fighting factor. Israel has today created the nearest thing to instant victory the modern world has ever seen.
And the turning point for him was his experience of the June 1967 Arab-Israeli War, which he witnessed and experienced living in New York in exile in the United States and watching Israel swiftly defeat the Egyptian, Jordanian, and Syrian militaries, and hearing on at the days, those days, he used to speak about listening to the transistor radios. And he said that you would always hear people saying, "How are we doing?" Meaning Israelis. How are they doing, the Arabs?
Andrew Rubin, who was Edward Said's research assistant from 1995 until Said's death in 2003.
And this separation became this kind of turning point in his life. And he was asked by his friend Ibrahim Abu Lugod, to whom he dedicates Orientalism, to write this essay that became the kernel of Orientalism. And the essay was called The Arab Portrayed. And the essay, he writes this essay shortly after the war in 1968. And that's the seed that germinates over the next 9 years into the book Orientalism. He was apolitical before this, really, the Arab-Israeli war. It was that war and his experience of it in exile that made him aware of his position in some ways.
The apolitical English professor after 1967 became politically active in the Palestinian movement. He joined the Palestine National Council, the Parliament of the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO. Said continued his outspoken activism for the Palestinian cause until his death. But it wasn't his activism that literally shook up the academic world of Middle East studies. It was Orientalism, a work of literary criticism shaped by the ideas of the rather complex French philosopher Michel Foucault, who wrote about the relationships between knowledge and power.
Well, it was received as a bombshell. It was sort of an exposé of scholarship, both classical Orientalist, meaning historical and linguistically based, as well as contemporary, meaning present-day social science at that time.
Professor Robert Springborg, a specialist in Egyptian politics, taught in Australia from the 1970s to the late 1990s before going to teach at universities in the US and Europe.
Certainly the book focused on the former, namely classical Orientalism, but it also weighed in against the contemporary so-called Orientalists, those doing contemporary social science, and it really, for both fields, caused a fundamental sort of reevaluation. So it I suppose, had more of an impact on contemporary and historical scholarship than any other book I can think of.
Did it kind of shake up your previous ideas about Egyptian history and the role of the West?
I suppose one never likes to admit that one's views are wrong, but probably they were. It certainly caused me to think about how I had done things, and was I an Orientalist, and if so, what could I do to redeem my sinning? And so, yes, I think it caused just about everybody working in the field at that time to sort of reevaluate what they'd done. And that's a pretty rare accomplishment for any scholarly work, because most of us are so dead set in our ways that we don't ever really question them fundamentally. But I must say that Edward Said's Orientalism really, really did cause people to do that, including yours truly.
The key historical moment for Edward Said in his book Orientalism is Napoleon's conquest of Egypt in 1798. Napoleon's success in conquering Egypt was to mix cultural power with military might. To quote Said, to convince the Egyptians that what he was doing was in the interests of Islam. Napoleon employed hundreds of French Orientalists to achieve his military goals. It was the turning point in Orientalism's transformation from academic study to political doctrine. Napoleon even created for his travelling band of Orientalists a special institute in Egypt. Said calls them a learned division of the French army, a permanent fact-finding mission for the occupation.
One of the extraordinary things about Napoleon's expedition was that it was meant to be a national expedition. In other words, it wasn't just an Englishman going or a part of the East India Company, like William Jones, for example, who went to India in the 70s and went to study the place and to work in the company. But it was meant to be a national project. It was, as one of the writers of the Description de l'Égypte, which is the great monument of his expedition, a 24-volume work that came out of the expedition, said in the preface that when Napoleon went to Egypt, it was really France going to the Orient and standing there on this magnificent world stage and dealing with the Orient in a way that had never been done before. And it was with that extraordinary self-consciousness that the expedition accomplished its aims. So in that sense, I think it can be described as the first formal intervention in the Orient on the part of the West. National, political, I mean, Napoleon was there obviously because he wanted to get in the way of the British Empire. So there was that there. And he also wanted to confront the world of Islam, as he said. And above all, he wanted not only simply to dominate it, but he wanted to appropriate it and make it available to Europe. And that was the whole point of the institute that he sort of set up there. A lot of scholars, biologists, linguists, archaeologists, people who were studying how the Egyptians embalmed their people and so on. I mean, it was a fantastic spread of things. All of this, it strikes me as symbolically as well as actually the first great monument of Orientalist study. And the others have followed more or less in the footsteps, but without quite the grandeur and even melodrama of Napoleon's.
Edward Said, in an interview I did with him for the ABC radio program Broadband in April 1979. One of the others was the British Empire in their occupation of Egypt in the late 19th century. Despite Egyptians agitating for self-government, British imperial politicians claimed the British knew what the Egyptians wanted, and the Orientals have no tradition of self-government. This kind of knowledge passed on to politicians came from Orientalists, like the French scholars Ernest Renan and Sylvestre de Sacy, or the English author Edward William Lane. All had distorted their scholarship, claimed Said, with a mixture of prejudice and often racist assumptions.
Since Renan and Lane, for instance, and Sacy had said that historically there's no evidence that Orientals, if you look at them with European eyes, had any traditions of democratic self-government, therefore the Orientals could be ruled despotically and indeed, in a sense, sort of required that sort of rule. And that became the argument for maintaining despotic European rule in places like Egypt and India. That was one thing. The other thing, and I think even more important than that, underlying all of the Oriental writing, underlying the charm of the exotic and so on and so forth, was the fundamental proposition that the Orient was in nearly every way that counted inferior to the Occident. And the idea of the civilizing mission, which you see in fictional works, say, at the end of the 19th century, like Heart of Darkness by Conrad, becomes a kind of a superimposed rationalization for colonial rule, that these are inferior people and we are here to bring them up to our standard. We are the bringers of light and progress. And they are in desperate need of it because they are, after all, slothful. They are, after all, corrupt and sensual and so on and so forth. And texts were adduced to support this thesis. In other words, you would find a learned Orientalist in the university, say Cambridge or Oxford, who had never been to the Orient, passing out these very powerful edicts about the Oriental character or the Oriental mentality. The thesis being that everything in the Orient was Oriental. And indeed, as I say, governments began to depend more and more upon this and upon learned experts. And certainly, for example, Macaulay in 1835 in the Minute on Indian Education, you know, cites the Orientalists as saying, well, they're the authorities on Arabic and Sanskrit, and they say that nothing in Arabic or Sanskrit can compare, he says, with the paltry abridgments to be found in an English boys' preparatory school, in the library of a school like that. And therefore, everybody in India should be converted from studying in their native language to studying in English. And that's the way policy was made.
This is Rear Vision with Stan Correy on ABC Radio National RN. And we're looking at the political and cultural legacy of Edward Said's 1978 book, Orientalism. If he'd simply attacked the classic Orientalists of the 18th and 19th centuries, the book Orientalism might have been less controversial. But Said argued that Oriental studies hadn't really changed much in the 20th century. and that the Orientalist mindset still ruled in the Middle East Studies departments of major universities. Was Edward Said unfair in being so critical of modern scholars of the Middle East and Islam?
Well, he may or may not have been unfair. I myself think that the key insight, I mean, there are many insights in that book, but the key insight in it is putting scholarship in context, and in particular, putting it in the context of power. So American social scientists or American historians or American scholars who are out in the Middle East are not operating in a neutral zone.
Palestinian-American historian Rashid Khalidi, the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University.
And Edward's work gave us a framework through which to understand that. So it was quite a revelation. I mean, he took on people who were the teachers of my own teachers. He took on Sir Hamilton Gibb. He took on people whose work I had read and admired, French scholars. And he put them in context in a way that made us understand how that work, while of enormous scholarly merit, and he always recognized that, was also playing an important political role in terms of the way in which it served power, and in the case of the British and the French, colonial power.
Yes, some people say he was too hard on the classic Orientalists. You're saying that it wasn't that he didn't appreciate the work that they had done, but he was just saying that you had to see it in relation to other things. Is that right?
Yes, and then some. You had to see it in relation to power. I mean, people like Gibb were working for the British government. Great French scholars were working for the French government. They were involved in the subjugation and in the oppression of the peoples whom they were studying. And nobody had ever brought that out. That's the first point. The second point is he had an enormous appreciation for the philology and the classical scholarship of many of the greatest Orientalists. I mean, he appreciated the extraordinary work that went into their scholarly output. But what he objected to was the way in which many of them tied their understanding of the present in the Middle East to 7th and 8th and 10th century texts, as if nothing had ever changed and these things could only be interpreted, these societies, these current modern-day societies, could only be interpreted in terms of their ancient texts, which is like trying to understand Australia in terms of St. Thomas Aquinas. And that's what many of the Orientalists, in fact, were doing, and that's one reason they were so wrong.
You know, his argument really was that classical Orientalists, especially the French, Ernst Renan and others, had worked with the French in their colonization of North Africa, most notably. And in that, he was absolutely correct. They had, in a sense, been trialing their theories of the Orient, hand in glove with the French Foreign Legion and the Quai d'Orsay and so on. And so historically, there were certainly good grounds for his critique of collaboration between these historical Orientalists and imperialism of the classical variety, 19th to early 20th century. And he was also not entirely wrong, at least, in his argument that contemporary Middle Eastern scholarship was a handmaiden of neocolonialism, because there were certainly those among us studying the Middle East who worked in government, as indeed I did. But I think that the impact of the classical Orientalists was much greater on French colonial policy, and indeed on British colonial policy, than anything the academics were saying to government decision makers, whether in Australia or the United States. These folks in government had their own agendas, and academics were pretty marginal to that. They'd be brought in very subsidiary roles. But to argue that they shaped the outlook of decision makers in the same way that, say, Ernst Renan had done for the French was an overstatement of it. And so he, Edward Said, sort of drew a strong parallel between the two, when I think there was one strong track and one much weaker one. And so in that sense, I think he overstated his indictment of contemporary Middle Eastern studies.
It took some time, but by 1986, open warfare broke out in the academic world. At the 20th anniversary meeting of the Middle East Studies Association of North America, it occurred at a debate entitled The Scholars, the Media and the Middle East. On the panel, which included British journalist Christopher Hitchens, Edward Said and his arch opponent, the premier Orientalist, British-American historian Bernard Lewis.
I do not see my function here this morning as that of a gladiator, a bullfighter, a gunfighter, or any other kind of fighter, nor as a duelist. I come as a scholar to an organization of professional concern to all of us. I think we all know that nothing that we say or do here this morning is going to have the slightest effect in the Middle East. We can change nothing. We can't even change each other's opinions, as we know from long experience.
Some of the scholars persist in characterizing what they do as impartial or detached or expert. This is the point, and it raises the, to me at least, profoundly interesting question of how these scholars in the group continue to practice their art while remaining hostile, or at least antithetical to and substantially reserved about its central object, the religion and culture of Islam. The roster I have in mind is responsible for what is essentially the entire gamut of media representation of the Middle East. It includes Bernard Lewis, Elie Kaddouri, Walter LeCur, Ernest Gellner, Conor Cruz O'Brien, Martin Peretz, Norman Podhoretz, J.B. Kelly, Daniel Pipes. I could go on.
Edward Said, Palestinian activist and literary scholar, continued to publish academic and political books on Palestinian politics and on Islam, and, as well, work at his day job as an expert on Western literature and theory. Literary critic and former research assistant for Said, Andrew Rubin.
What I really saw him do was that he had the ability to write in so many different registers. So he writes Orientalism, and it's part of a trilogy. The next book is The Question of Palestine, which is much more political. And then the most popular book of that trilogy is Covering Islam. And so these books are each written for different kinds of audiences. So he could write for a theoretical audience on the one hand, and then write for The Guardian on the next day on the other. So it's true that Orientalism was written as is addressed to certain scholars in the academy, who were making some false distinction between pure knowledge, which was never really pure, and political knowledge, which was somehow easily dismissed. So yeah, it does participate in that debate over jargon and so on. And he did have the ability, I think, to write to simplify complex ideas when he wanted to in certain situations, which made him the figure I think he in the end was. I mean, if he spoke like he did in Orientalism every day, I don't think he would be been the figure he became.
Orientalism, a polemic against everything Western. It launched 1,000 PhDs, or a book that set out to delegitimize Western scholarship. Despite the attacks and counterattacks in the West and East of the past 40 years, Orientalism's reputation as a key cultural text is secure. Edward Said's friend and colleague, Nubar Hovsepian, recently attended an international conference in China on the influence of Orientalism.
Orientalism has been misinterpreted by many people in the Arab world and in the Middle East and in the third world countries to the point where they created the reversed understanding of an Occidentalism. He was trying to dismantle structures of knowledge that created spaces East and West as fixed, unchanging. And then he adds to that knowledge and the humans change the world, and therefore let's look at forms of resistance, of ideas, of identities that can expedite the process of change. So I would say that, like each book, as Said also understands it, the book becomes many books depending on the reader. You know, the fact is that today, in 40th anniversary, the book is still celebrated. I was in China in May. There are two different editions, one in Taiwan, one in the mainland of Orientalism. And what's interesting, there are more of Said's books published in Chinese than in Arabic. That's an interesting point to be made. And his work has an afterlife because readers see it in different contexts, in different time, and that they can continue to develop the critical observations that he registered, which is what an intellectual's job is all about, is to challenge existing authority and to insist that no knowledge is unchanging.
Orientalism is a modern classic, and whether you agree with his ideas or not, Edward Said's thoughts about the conflicts between political power and cultural identity still resonate in the West and the Orient. Here's Edward Said speaking on ABC Radio in 1980.
I think it's the conventional wisdom of anybody, whether he knows anything about Islam or not, who goes to, say, universities and is educated and belongs to a culture such as this one, the non-white, non-European world ought to be subsidiary or somehow subordinate, not a challenge of any real sort to the values and powers of this culture. And this sudden explosion, Iran, the Palestinians, the Africans, etc., all through the third world, of people who simply are not content to remain quiet in their lot as sort of secondary to and dependent upon the West is a frightening and scary phenomenon. And it's therefore, it seems to me, logical and understandable to say, these are all parts of the same thing. They're all the same thing. They're all Islam. They're all this non-white kind of scary world, and therefore we will treat them that way. It's part of an extremely unpleasant and dangerous cycle, because when you are focused on and you are the recipient of a lot of attention of people speaking about you as Islam and the Islamic this and the Islamic mind, the Islamic hordes and the Islamic so on and so forth, then, and certainly this has been the case in Iran, and I think accounts for a lot of what has been disappointing in the course of the Iranian revolution in the last a year now, is this sense in which you use Islam. In other words, Islam becomes, instead of being the complex thing that it is, becomes a war cry. It becomes a slogan that is used because it's what is expected of you. And it's also a way of defending yourself against all these outside forces, whether they're the Soviet Union or the West. As a result of which, of course, within the society itself, there develops a kind of paranoia. You know, it's possible to see that adjectives like un-Islamic. I mean, you could see this already in the exchange between Khomeini and Sadat. You know, Sadat saying Khomeini is really not Islamic. And, you know, I am the true Islamic, the bearer of true Islamic values. This man is a lunatic. There's a kind of paranoia which develops. And the complex forces of a society which has just been released from a certain oppression placed upon it, say, like in Iran, tends to coalesce around the lowest common denominator, which happens to be kind of Islamic nationalism. But you see, the point about that would be that that has nothing to do with Islam as Islam. It's something that would be common to any cultural system.
The late Edward Said, Professor of Comparative Literature at Columbia University. You also heard Professor Robert Springborg, writer and literary scholar Andrew Rubin, Nuba Hovsepian, Associate Professor of Political Science at Chapman University, and Rashid Khalidi, Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University in New York. Russell Stapleton is the sound engineer for this Rear Vision on RN. Thanks for listening. And goodbye from Stan Correy.